Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilesh and John McElroy, episode 374 for April 21st, 2017. Buick's future is Avenir. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. As you can see, it's just me today. John is on assignment, but I'm not alone, not by a long shot. And so one of the things that occurred to me is that, you know, I always introduce our journalistic guests and we just say what their name is and where they're working now, and you have no sense of the depth of knowledge that these people have. So, first of all, Joanne Mueller, she's with Forbes, Detroit Bureau Chief of Forbes, been with Forbes for 15 years. Before that, worked for Business Week. Before that, the Boston Globe. And before that, the Detroit Free Press. So, my point is, if you want to know stuff about the auto business, Joanne, wealth of knowledge. So,
been doing it a while.
Been doing it a while, and I mean, so again, so for you guys have questions out there, I mean, Joanne is a very smart person. We also have Mike Austin. Now, Mike Austin is the editor-in-chief of Autoblog, and he's been with Autoblog for a couple of years, right?
Yep.
Okay, and before that, automotive editor of Popular Mechanics.
Yep.
And before that, you were the tech editor at Car and Driver.
Yes.
And before that, you were the road test editor at what was one of my all-time favorite magazines, MPH, which had a very short shelf life. But
yeah, thanks. I was worried you were going to say, like, and Mike's just here.
So the tech editor, road test editor, you know, editor of Autoblog, which is like, you know, the hugest thing on the internet. So again, you have questions about cars, we got Mike here to answer those questions. So we got it covered both ways.
I think it makes us sound extremely old. Extremely
smart.
Okay.
All right. So our special guest, the reason we're here is we have Jace Stokes, product manager for the Buick Enclave. Now, Jace, you've been with General Motors for 30-some years.
35 years. 35 enjoyable years. Spent first portion of my career with Pontiac. Some great experiences and memories there, but been with Buick and so happy to be a part of the all-new Enclave, especially the first ever Avenir that I'm anxious to talk to you about. And really, you know, Buick, it's a great time to be with Buick, and I think the marketplace is recognizing, you know, we are a modern, forward-thinking, nimble brand that our customers through awards are telling us that they love our products for their style, their beautiful interiors, comfortable, quiet character, as well as nimble precision performance.
So the new Enclave was basically revealed to the world just last week at the New York Auto Show.
Just last week in New York, we revealed the first ever Avenir, and it just made all the right sense to debut that on Enclave. You know, Enclave has very strong credentials in the marketplace. Certainly, it stood the test of time, and it's known for its beautiful character inside and out, tremendously comfortable seating with whisper quiet interior, flourishes conversations, a premium smooth ride, along with an unexpected level of interior accommodation and space.
So let me ask you a very simple, basic question. So describe for our audience what this vehicle is.
You know, we really think Enclave is the answer for what a luxurious 7-passenger midsize SUV ought to be. And you know, people look to this vehicle for these characteristics that I've just described. You know, beautiful design, and we've taken the new Enclave and created a more athletic, dynamic, planted stance. Our designers lowered the roofline just a little bit, a steeper rake on the windshield, stretched the wheelbase out, and pushed the wheels all the way to four corners. So it really does have this planted, dynamic, athletic stance. Interior is absolutely gorgeous. Can't wait for everyone to see the interior. Premium use of materials. It is luxuriously huge on the inside. We've carved out 10% more interior space when you include the underfloor storage in the back. And we've been able to enhance the ride even further by an all-new chassis and suspension system. So I think once people experience the all-new Enclave driving the vehicle, you'll see within a few minutes how much more refined it is.
You guys dropped some weight on it too, right? Something like 400 pounds?
Yeah, it's a good question. Through a lot of engineering ingenuity, we took about 350 pounds out. That was not the focus. When you want an incredibly comfortable, quiet vehicle that delivers so much in accommodation and space, it's really hard. It takes mass to do that. But there are some efficiencies gained. The real improvement, too, is with the powertrain. So we've been able to increase the power from 288 to just over 300 horsepower. An all-new 9-speed transmissions. We add 3 speeds. And it really delivers an unexpected level of performance for a vehicle of this size.
Did you have a benchmark vehicle you were going for?
We focused on a primary and a secondary competitor. The Acura MDX was our primary competitor. The Infiniti QX60 is the secondary. This is truly a luxurious vehicle, and it's going to compete against luxury midsize SUVs. Yet there's other outreach. There'd be move-ups from Highlander, Pilot, or CX-9. But we really think we have an outstanding opportunity with the all-new first-ever Avenir that's really going to push us further into the mid-lux space than we've ever been before. And quite frankly, it is the most expensive Enclave that we've ever built.
So this is a trim level. I mean, is it a trim level, first of all?
It's a trim level. And so our lineup will be 4 trim levels, an Enclave, an Essence, a Premium, and then the all-new first-ever Avenir. And really, the marketplace communicated very strongly that there was a need for this new top trim. Over 90% of what we sell retail is the top 2 trims, the Essence and the Premium. The Premium was running 40%. Wow. And then of those vehicles, half were transacting well above $50,000. So,
wow.
there was a strong message from the marketplace. Our customers were telling us we love the vehicle, we love it fully equipped, and we'd like to see something more. And we're anxious to be able to give them that now.
So the Enclave, we're now in the second generation of this product. So through its history before this, it's been doing very well for Buick. It's a hot segment, as everyone knows, but particularly for what...
Gary, you're absolutely right. It's defied traditional life cycles. And again, this design has really stood the test of time. And just enhancing, we've got a great car, and we've made the new one greater. So we really built upon the strengths of the existing car, and we know customers, it's going to delight them even further.
The thing that always surprised me, the first time that I got into, the previous generation car was that, everybody talks about, 3-row seating. And, you get back into that back row and you're, chewing on your knees because it's so tight. But
yeah.
There was room in, it's like you could be like a grown human being and sit there and not
right.
feel as though you were, need to go to a yoga class or something to get untwisted.
I never take shots at competitors. We hear a lot of 7-passenger capability out there. But to your point, I'm not aware of any others that really have the kind of space in the third row. And we're really anxious when I talked about a 10% overall space improvement. Most of that came in the second and third row, and customers will notice that in headroom, shoulder room, hip room, and leg room. And then the real advantage is behind the third row. We've carved out an additional 27% of additional space. So I was just under 20 cubic feet. We're up just under 25 cubic feet. So there's plenty of space for everyone's belongings. And then the underload floor storage that we do have, we've almost tripled the size of that space. So we're now 3.1 cubic feet, when before we were less than 2. It's 10 inches deep. So, again, it's just an unexpected level of interior
space. How do you discover space like that you haven't had before? that's a very big leap. I guess I'm kind of wondering why not earlier.
It's a big leap, and a lot of it had to do with extending the wheelbase and packaging this all-new 5-link independent suspension system, which is a great enhancement to the overall vehicle ride and handling quality of the vehicle. So in doing so, we were able to, again, maximize some of this interior space, primarily second and third row, behind the third row, and especially underneath the floor.
Mm. When you talk about the third row, sorry, Joanne, this might make you feel old, but when the first generation car came out, this was, they focused on the third row a lot because they were saying all our minivan buyers are going to transition into these three rows. This is where the market's moving, which turned out to be a pretty good crystal ball there. But just looking back at that from this sort of positioning this as saying, hey, you know, we're going to capture minivan buyers to where Buick as a brand is now and where the car is, that's a really big change. It's, I mean, 10 years, but, I mean, how does that feel, the transformation? What's that been like for you?
You know, I mean, the SU segments are hot. You know, we know that. But the midsize segment is still very strong. You know, Buick, you know, modern, forward-thinking, nimble brand that's able to respond quickly to market trends. So we saw what Encore did. We saw what Envision did. And now the all-new Enclave. But we're so excited about the Avenir. And, you know, we had some very successful concepts that I know you remember, the Avenir sedan and then the Avista sport coupe. And so you see a lot of, you know, the design cues from those very successful concepts in the Avenir. But it does bring us to an all-new level of luxury, and there are some specific unique technologies and so forth that come in that. I'd like to talk about one of them if I could.
Sure, please.
We have, you know, we're anxious to see what customers think about a vehicle that constantly monitors the air in which you breathe inside the cabin, whether that's air being recirculated inside or coming in from the outside. And it's called an in-vehicle ionizer, and it looks for any bad germs, odors, pollens in the air, and it creates these negatively charged particles that attack, break them down, and they drop to the floor out of the path that you breathe. So, you know, Buick has been known for incredibly comfortable interiors, incredibly quiet interiors, and we now want to own air quality, and we want our customers to feel a sense of well-being when they're traveling in the vehicle. And we've all been with people, flu or cold season. I just think it's peace of mind, it's reassurance, knowing that there's technology working to try and keep you healthy. And
why did you think of that? I mean, you know, she's saying, where'd you get the space? I'm thinking, like, where did you think that the you know, vehicle would use something like this?
You know, it's a sense of well-being. We want people to feel totally comfortable in the vehicle, and quite frankly, we can't think of a better vehicle, more enjoyable vehicle to take a long trip in with people, 7 full-size people, if that's what it might be.
It can't heal me if I'm sick, yeah, but it can keep me from getting my kids cold.
It can help reduce the likelihood of you breathing in any of these germs or any of these bad airborne particulates.
That's a pretty good.
He's
job.
Not a doctor, though. I just want to make that clear. He's.
I mean, did you guys have any tests where, like, you know, somebody eats a shawarma in the car and you find out how quickly the smell goes away or something? Or,
you know, that's a good point. You know, I mean, so it does attack odors. And, you know, knowing that these vehicles are lifestyle vehicles, I think we've all been in a situation where baseball, football practice or hockey practice and some of the smells associated with that, you know, so it'll attack those as well. So we're just really excited about this all-new in-vehicle ionizer technology, and that's going to be rolling out all across all Buicks.
All right, so you've got another thing on this, which sounds fairly complicated, the Avonic Acrolite lighting technology.
Nice job pronouncing that. That's accurate. So this is a first for Buick, and this technology is not new, but I would say the Buick application is probably the most sophisticated application that we've done with this material. And when you see the all-new vehicle and the headlamps, just the shape and the geometry of the material, it's a translucent material. We have over 100 LEDs across the vehicle, and so it lights up these lenses. And during the day, it really gives you a dynamic look. But at night, it's going to own the road, and we're confident people are going to say, Buick nailed the lighting on that car. It will look unlike anything else that you've seen out there.
And one thing before take a break. So does Avenir mean something?
Avenir, it's a French word, means future, and that's kind of the Buick direction. You know, modern, nimble, forward-thinking, identifying new segments in the market and rapidly trying to fill those segments with exciting products. So it's just forward-thinking that Buick is always looking for new opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to be right back. I got a whole bunch of questions here from the audience. We're going to
look forward to it.
We're going to hear from our friends at Lear. So.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Yeah, don't let them drive.
Okay, and we're back with Jay Stokes from Buick, Mike Austin, and Joanne Mueller. Okay, so from the audience, Kevin Corpetti Vasquez via email and Rusty Nevitz via Twitter both have a similar sort of question. When is Buick going to present us with a luxury hybrid EV or fuel cell vehicle?
I really can't comment on future products, but that's not to say that that isn't in the hopper.
Okay. Wright Knight, he has a comment here. He says, this Buick needs a two-tone paint job broken at the sweep spear. Stat.
That's an interesting comment. You know, we do have a lower accent color. There's three different lower accents that coordinate with the 10 different exterior colors that you can get on the vehicle. So there's a little bit of that. But I think for the most part, the monochromatic look, I think, works very well on the vehicle. And then a generous use of very sculpted chrome pieces throughout, I think, really make quite a statement. But again, unmistakably Avenir.
Is color different today than it was 5 years ago? I mean, in terms of what people's expectations are?
See, we primarily use premium colors now, premium metallics, tint coats, and tri-coats. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think color is very important to customers. And having, the right colors, especially with the right interior colors so that they harmonize well, is very important.
When you look at that, you think about, like things like the Chevy Redline trims or like other companies doing, blacked out trim, and you look at the life cycle of the car, do you see anything where you might do some sort of appearance package, whether it's part of Avenir or its own thing?
We did, on the current, and in fact, I was part of it. We had two special editions. We did a Tuscan special edition, where we took the existing waterfall grille, we created a bronze look on it, and then we had bronze spoke pockets in the wheels. And then we followed that with a sport touring, where it was kind of a blacked out version of that waterfall grille along with the black spoke pockets. And it worked very well. It works well for customers because, dealers and I think customers would tell you they like most differentiation on the exterior. So it kind of makes a statement about who they are. And it draws attention about the vehicle in the showroom or certainly in the dealer a lot. So I think having some differentiation throughout the life cycle is important, and that's certainly a strategy for Buick.
George from Sunnyvale, why are you using the same complicated, that's in scare quotes, electronic shifter that is in the Cadillac XTS, Buick LaCrosse, and Chevy Bolt? As you know, people have been complaining about how confusing it is to use. Cadillac, Buick, and Chevy have all created YouTube videos to try to explain how to use this shifter, yet in other cars, no video is necessary because using the shifter is intuitive.
It does several things. It frees up a lot of space for us, and I think you'll see in the all-new Enclave, we've got a large storage area below the console now that's opened up for any additional storage, a purse, any kind of belongings there. I have to be honest, someone's first reaction to it, it might not be intuitive, but it's a very simple system to use. I think you all have experienced it. You have one side button. Your thumb comes out of park, down into gear. It really is probably a safer system. You can instantly hit the park button, automatically goes into park. If the vehicle is not in park and the door is open for any reason, it goes into park. So I think it's just another precision technology that people will get accustomed to and appreciate for what it's there for.
Yeah, there's very little movement. You're moving your thumb and then you're moving just, I don't know.
Yeah, for me it was learned behavior. Like, you have to learn to deliberately push the button instead of like the normal sliding.
Right. Yes, I found myself going into neutral when I wanted to go into reverse, and I realized, I got to hit the button again.
Hit the button.
Yeah.
But it is a little bit of a joystick.
And then going to drive is easy as pie.
Drive's easy.
Yeah. And we're seeing different transmission configurations, whether it's push buttons or dials or what have you. So this just seems to be going down that
path. It's going down that path, and it still does resemble a shifter, mm-hmm. Where others are using push buttons and so forth. So
Glenn wants to know, do you have any plans on offering a sports package? What would you add for better handling, sports seats, whatever?
We mentioned a sport touring model that we would be offering on this this product. I think it would probably be based more on appearance only, just because we've really enhanced the suspension system already with the 5-link electronic power steering. We've reduced our turning radius by almost a foot and a half. So when you think about how nimble the vehicle used to be, especially in tight maneuvering situations, parking lots now, we're reducing almost a foot and a half further. I think, again, people will just be amazed at how easy this vehicle is to drive given its size.
Mm-hmm. Is there any leeway with the all-wheel drive system? Because if I remember correctly, it will do side-to-side torque vectoring. I mean, is there any leeway there if you wanted to program it for a sportier thing, for a like a sport model?
In our new twin cluts, it's available on our top two trims. Mm-hmm. You're correct. It acts as if it's a limited slip rear differential in the vehicle. So it does enhance overall traction, stability, and vehicle control. There are no current plans to do any kind of calibration changes to that, but that's not to say within the life cycle there would be opportunities to take a look at that.
You know, we were talking about the transmission and just sort of passed by that it's a 9-speed transmission.
It's an all-new 9-speed transmission that's standard in the vehicle. And, you know, we don't talk about fuel economy. Obviously, there's some fuel economy enhancements, but really in this segment for what this vehicle delivers, you know, fuel economy is not a reason for purchase. We're confident about this segment of vehicles. Fuel prices are low. And I think just, again, these active lifestyle families that need that kind of space, I mean, this just is going to meet their needs and then some.
Can it tow?
Great question. We now have enhanced towing from 4,500 up to 5,000 pounds, which is enough to tow a 21-foot sport boat. So any of your toys more than capable to tow it with 7 full-size adults, and remember all their belongings behind that third row seat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got two from Roll Tide, and I'm going to combine them. So, one is, how much larger is the Enclave compared to the Envision, and will the Enclave exclusively be a three-row vehicle? And the second question is, how does an Enclave Avenir differ from an Acadia Denali?
Well, those are good questions. So obviously, the Envision is a compact SUV, and the Enclave is a midsize SUV. We say midsize, but it's a large midsize. I call it a full-size. The Avenir, highest expression of Buick luxury, and its focus, I think, is more on just luxurious interior, unique technologies, and so forth. Similar in some ways to Denali, but Denali takes on more of a professional grade, I think a more capable role, where I think Avenir is going to focus more on luxurious ride, luxurious feel, luxurious materials, and technologies.
We've got one here from Armand. You say the Enclave customers are choosing the top two trim levels, which led to Avenir. Are these customers in the U.S. or China, and are there any aspects of the vehicle that are just China-oriented?
So the all-new Enclave is not going to be sold in China, so these are strictly 100% U.S. customers. The vehicle will be marketed in North America, which includes Canada, and then in Mexico. These vehicles transacted well above $50,000, and the opportunity to reach further into mid-lux segment is exciting for us, and we know the vehicle will do that.
So, you know, I'm sort of wondering, you guys are doing, you know, as I said earlier, very well with this vehicle. Are you seeing transaction costs increasingly going up for vehicles? And, I mean, any Buicks for that matter.
You know, we are seeing, you see GM reports average transaction prices. I think we're leading the industry as far as features and technologies that our customers are embracing and wanting. And the same holds true for Buick as well as Enclave. You know, currently right now we're in a sell-down mode as we bring the new vehicle to market. And it'll be in market the fourth quarter of this year. So it'll be at a dealership near you. Look forward to everyone experiencing it. We think there's great opportunity for this product, and average transaction prices we think will increase mm-hmm. as a result of Avenir.
Are you seeing increased loan lengths to go with those transaction prices? I mean, it's a trend that other...
Yeah, it's a trend. You know, I think you see our advertising. We generally do not advertise 72-month contracts. I see other manufacturers doing that and even going longer. It's kind of scary. I think we focus more on we'll occasionally have 16% off sales that do very well for us. Our lease buy rate is probably kind of flip-flop based on some of the other luxury brands. So, you know, we see more people that buy the vehicle versus lease. That may change a little bit with Avenir. It's currently right now about a 65-35 split between buy and lease.
Well, one of the things I've been sort of thinking about is that in many ways, Buick, as your product has improved so dramatically, and the premium level of it has gone up, the third party reviews are very high. I almost think that Buick is sort of moving into the space that Lexus kind of vacated when they went sharply in the direction of performance and much more aggressive styling. Is that a fair observation?
That's fair to say, because we are a luxurious brand, and not to say that we don't have spirited performance, but the focus is clearly on beautiful exterior and interior, premium use of materials and leathers, utilizing noise-canceling headphone technologies to even further quiet down the interiors. And you know what we find in this vehicle is, in this day and age, people don't seem to communicate the old-fashioned way on trips, and that's just by conversation and speech. And in a lot of cases, because it's uncomfortable to try and do that. So kids are either texting or, people find other ways to try and occupy their time. But, when you're in such a comfortable, quiet vehicle like Enclave, that you have all kinds of space and accommodations, you can relive past memories or you can create new ones. And so we find the families that really look towards vehicles like this, that's the kind of vehicle they're looking for, something that they can kind of get their loved ones back together with or their family and friends. And it's not only a reward for themselves, but they want to equally share that reward, that comfort, and that quiet space with others. So I think it's a win-win.
Which is not to say that you don't have technology galore in this vehicle. We were talking before the show about technology, and I see this has got 17 sensors. You've got radar and ultrasonic cameras.
We got fully equipped 17 different ultrasonic sensors, cameras, and radars. We have a full display rear camera mirror that acts as a manual mirror as well if you choose to do so. We have 360 surround vision. We have a full host of active safety around the vehicle. And the safety alert GM seat, patented seat, that gives you the pulses depending on what object is around you. Now you can see everything around you. So we like to say, again, that's that sense of well-being. As you're in the vehicle, you can feel anything around you. You can see everything around you. All vehicles come standard with a hands-free lift gate. And, that sensor sometimes is difficult to find. So we now have an LED logo projection of the Buick Tri-Shield that displays on the ground. And that it helps you guide your foot, and it's just a step-through process to break the beam, so it comes on. And it'll come on 3 meters before you reach the car. So if you go into the grocery store and your hands are full, and as you walk, and, of course, your keys are in the pocket, that logo lamp illuminates. You take a step through with your step kick. Lift gate comes up, unload your arms, and you're all set to go.
That might be more clever than the air ionizer, I'm just saying.
But it is. It's just another Buick technology initiative here that just improves that overall ownership experience and that effortless driving.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Jay Stokes, we want to thank you for joining us on After Hours today and telling us all about the new Enclave and Avenir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Appreciate it very much.
Look forward to it again.
Okay. So now we're going to do one of those 37-second car reviews, and this will be the Chevy Trax. So we'll be right back.
This is 37 Seconds in the Autoline Garage.
The Chevy Trax is a compact sport utility sold on 5 continents and in 73 countries. Here in America, it's targeted at city-dwelling millennials who need to move around places like Chicago and Detroit. Now, if I were 25 and needed an athletic-looking vehicle equipped with Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, and built-in Wi-Fi that also had enough cargo space to carry the provisions for an urban garden, I would, make Trax to my local Chevy dealer. But even for those of us above the millennial age range, this is one compact SUV that does indeed deliver the goods.
This has been 37 Seconds in the Autoline Garage.
Okay, that was great. So we're at the time of the show where we're now doing Dr. Data. So you two have to figure out what this number will be. This one's really easy this week. It's almost embarrassing. It's so early. So easy. So Carmen, please bring up the first number. You guys will see it right there. So that's 64 million U.S. drivers. Okay, so what could 64 million U.S. drivers have in common? And for those of you who are listening to this and not seeing this, behind the text there is a pile of money. And there's something else going on, but I can't say that because I will give it away entirely. Well, sort of. Any idea what this might be?
No, I was going to go with some age demographic, but the clues don't.
All right, so the clue. Okay, so what you may not be able to discern from that is those vehicles are in.
Oh, they're crashing, aren't they?
They're crashed. Yes.
Yes.
Drive a damaged vehicle.
Uninsured motorists.
That's a good one.
All right, that's a good one, but it's not. So bring up the answer, please. Ta-da. Okay, the number of drivers that would go into debt to pay for accident repairs. 64 million Americans would go into debt if they got into an accident that cost them, and the average bill is $600. And this is, the source is AAA, so
my
insurance.
Answer was almost right.
Well, but I mean, so think about this. I mean, we were mentioning earlier about these long loans, right? Okay, but here we have a situation where people couldn't afford to fix their car. This astonishes only me?
No, well, this is the Atlantic had this was like a story over, I think, last fall or last winter, where this huge percentage of Americans can't get $400 together if they need to have it. Mm. You know, where it's like you have this like working middle class. And the thing with the cars and going into debt, that's what you saw during the mortgage crisis, was people were defaulting on their houses and keeping the car payment up because that's your livelihood. Mm-hmm. You need to use the car to get to work and do all the other things.
The other thing is, it costs a lot to fix a car these days because
right.
So many sensors, even if you knock out a taillight, you know, it's going to cost you thousands of dollars because mm-hmm. there's so much technology built in there.
Right.
That to me is a problem, but I don't
but
know
what. People going into debt to pay for these repairs?
I mean, again, it depends
people
on the repair.
Don't save.
Like the risk of, you know, people don't save, and then I'm not that surprised because the risk of losing the mobility, people depend on the car for mobility so heavily, they can't risk.
You know. Yeah. All right.
Are you a one percenter?
No, I mean, it's, but so many. I mean, that's a large percentage of the population,
yeah.
Right? Population is
yeah.
what, 300 million, give or take, right?
Yes.
So what are we talking here? Like, greater than about a fifth.
Yeah, a fifth.
Yeah,
a little bit. Yeah,
it's crazy. All right, so we'll move on from my fascination with that. But this is to another AAA study that just came out this week, which I thought was pretty amazing. So they claim, based on this study that they did from February 16th to 19th, that 1 in 6, 15%. Of Americans are likely to buy an electric vehicle the next time they're in the market for a newer used vehicle.
Wow.
18%, by the way.
15%.
But 1 in 6 is 18.
Well,
well, we got the math.
Speaking of the 18%, 18% of millennials are more likely to buy an electric vehicle than baby boomers at 10%. Gee, what a surprise that is, right?
I feel that the electric vehicle era is upon us. For a lot of reasons. I know they haven't sold until up till now, but I think people would like to buy them. They want to buy them. I happen to be driving a Chevy Bolt EV right now, and it's a hoot. It's really fun to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as long as you can be assured that, you know, you're not going to run out of range somewhere. And I think it's getting, if you look at the number of announcements just this week even, of charging infrastructure stuff that's going in, we're getting a lot more fast chargers. You know, Volkswagen, as part of their settlement for their diesel crimes, has to put in almost $1 billion into EV infrastructure. That's a huge amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel it's going to start snowballing. So I think that we could really see this. Also, the other thing is that a lot of this autonomous driving technology all is sort of built around the idea of electric infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
What's fascinating to me is the idea, you know, like that's exciting and like that's what's new. So people are interested in it. But when you look at combined hybrids and electrics, they're nowhere near 18%. So the question for me is, the cars are going to come online where it fits people's needs more. But then also, it is, where's that gap between, I love the idea of an electric car, but when it comes to buying it, what other factors like price or range are going to actually turn into sales?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have to sell them anyways. They have to bring them to market because the government has made it so. If there's no demand, they will discount them to the point where there is demand.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it's a shoo-in.
All right, so here's another. This is also from that AAA study. 4 out of 10, 43%.
I won't check you anymore.
Of U.S. I didn't do the math. Of U.S. drivers are planning to buy or lease a car for the next vehicle. That surprises me.
As opposed to what?
An SUV or a crossover.
Oh.
Okay.
40%?
Others are planning to select an SUV, 26%. Now, here's the number that is astonishing. Pickup truck, 16%. So if we were to go back to that electric vehicle thing, because you can't buy an electric pickup truck, correct?
You can buy a hybrid soon. Ford is going to have one, right?
Yeah, but we're talking pure EVs here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So isn't that number? 16% say they're going to buy a pickup truck. 16% say they're going to buy a hybrid, an electric vehicle. Again, you guys are not astonished.
Those numbers are not in sync with where we currently are, which isn't to say, EV sales are going to go up, things are going to move, and it speaks to the enthusiasm about it. But, like, just with cars, like, 40% of people still want to buy cars? That sounds so nice, because I don't see it going that way.
So what do you think it'll be? You can give numbers, in percentages even.
I mean, I don't live in that world as much as you guys do, but, I could see cars shrinking to, 30%. But, if gas prices go up or if EVs take off. And then you get into semantics, right? Because a lot of these crossovers now are really just tall cars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right. They're all under, 56 inches in height and things mm-hmm. like that.
All right, so here's this. I'm gonna sort of morph this, Joanne. This goes to your point. You're talking about the government insisting that there be sales of electric vehicles, mm-hmm. and that's basically the insistence is primarily, I would argue, in California, but that's neither here nor there.
And how many other states? 13 other? 11
the,
other?
The CARB states,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So Mike in San Francisco writes in, and all right, those of you at home, I'm just simply reading this. Don't get all agitated about this. The Republican Party has used the nuclear option, which means Donald Trump has control of the Supreme Court, meaning he can roll back all clean air legislation and or Obama executive orders. How do you think this will impact the auto business?
I have an answer for that.
I'm glad you do, because you know what? I don't.
The California has an exemption, a waiver, that is good at least through 2025, I believe it is. They have shown absolutely no intention of scaling back their ambitions for clean vehicles. You also have China, you have Europe, all of whom are dramatically ratcheting up their own regulatory standards. And if you ask anyone in the auto industry, they say, you know what? We need to keep developing these vehicles because we are global companies with global products. And so the U.S. risk is just that it falls behind. And what good is that, right? So it will happen. And I think the car makers are smart to just keep pushing ahead. And and I always believe that the best innovation comes when they are pushed really, really hard. They say they can't do it, and some great engineer inside the company does it. And mm-hmm. that's why we've gotten as far as we have. Now, granted, the hockey stick goes up dramatically from 2020, I guess it is, or 2022. I'm forgetting 2021. Okay, right in the middle there. Yeah, but it will get a lot harder. But they are. If you read any of those papers that come out of SAE, these guys are working hard on it, mm-hmm. and I believe they will get there. So, mm-hmm. If Trump rolls back all of the EPA regs, I don't think it's going to make a big difference as far as what the auto industry does.
Mm-hmm. You got to take it on that, Mike?
Yeah, I'm a little more skeptical just because of the way that they went immediately in and said, give us a break on these fuel economy numbers. And it was almost insulting, you had GM touting the Bolt and we're moving towards the future, and Ford talking about all the EVs they're going to make. And at the same time saying, hey, let's roll back these regulations so we can sell more trucks and keep making profit. And we've seen this play out before. Yeah. To your point, make money while they can, but I think that there's not enough incentive. There's enough profit incentive to stick to the cheap stuff and somewhat fairly, where they do run a huge risk of falling behind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I take some of his point, but I do think that you know, I haven't heard any automaker say, gosh, we want to roll back the regulations. What they've said is, EPA, you rushed through the midterm review without actually going through the process. And, you know, process is slow. I understand that. That's not really very good for advancement. But on the other hand, I think there is a little bit of an argument to say, okay, which technologies are working, you know, and just tinker with the regs from now to from 2022 to 2025, because maybe there is a little better way to get there. I believe they will get there, and I don't believe they're going to ask for rollbacks.
So, you know, you're mentioning other parts of the world, and so this week Volvo announced that it will begin building its first production electric vehicle in China. And it'll build it in China, and it'll export it to the rest of the world starting in 2019. And Volvo has a commitment to sell a total of 1 million electrified cars, but this also includes hybrids, not just pure EVs, by 2025. So this week, while we're sitting here, the Shanghai show is going on. And, I mean, I counted that Volkswagen showed the ID. Cross. Audi showed the e-tron Sportback, MG, the storied British brand that is now owned by the Chinese. They showed a EV coupe concept, and Bentley showed the EXP12 Speed 6e, an electric vehicle, and there are probably more.
I'll bet.
Okay, so does this just address China, or does this address the rest of the world with EVs?
I think we should get accustomed to the fact that China is going to start driving this industry, you know, if they aren't already. And I think that all those EVs are very important to China, but many of them or their technology will be here too. And I would not be surprised to see Volvo producing electrified vehicles in their plant in South Carolina within short order here. It doesn't open for another year, but.
So do you think these will be EVs or hybrids?
I think for many, it's going to be a plug-in hybrid solution, which is, to me, kind of the perfect bridge right now. Around town, take it for example, the Chrysler Pacifica, one of my favorite vehicles. It's a great minivan, for one thing, but it's great. It's got this electrified, 38 miles, I think, around town. The majority of people who are driving minivans are schlepping, right? Back and forth to school, grocery store, soccer practice, whatever. You'll never use a drop of gas. But when you want to go on that road trip, which you also use your minivan for, it's just like your old minivan as far as using gas. So to me, a plug-in hybrid's a really good solution. You know, there needs to be ZEV vehicles for California.
And those other
meaningful
states. Meaningful electrics.
Yes, zero emission vehicles can only be electric or hydrogen right now, unless somebody invents something else.
I mean, for me, it speaks to that global picture. You know, like the way maybe we used to look at Europe for, you know, compact platforms and smaller engines. You wrote a piece a couple weeks ago about Buick, and their China volume is like five times that of the U.S., and they have an electrified platform in the pipeline there. Because of the volume of China and the scale of China, I think it allows you that flexibility. So maybe if we do have, you know, they revisit the regulations and whether they slacken or not, or if our regulations just trail the rest of the world, you know, a company that has a good presence in China can look at that and say, well, we can just plug in models as the market changes. So, you know, yeah, I think China's going to drive it, but I think the upside of that is it allows, nobody's building regional platforms really anymore, so it'll allow that adaptability.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to take another break. And then we've got much more to talk about, and probably no percentages, though. But I think it's done. So we're going to hear from our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, and we are back. So while we're talking about things related to electrified vehicles and more advanced technology, we actually have a phone call from Clem regarding the Honda fuel cell. So could you please bring the phone call in, and we'll see if we can answer the question.
This is Clem Zarovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. I read someplace that Honda is using the GM fuel cell. Is that true? Thank you very much. Bye.
So who wants to answer that?
I don't know. I
mean, okay. They're not. Okay, yeah, so
they have a joint project to develop the next generation fuel cell. The current in the Honda Clarity that has just gone on sale, it is a Honda developed fuel cell, but the next generation will be jointly developed with GM and Honda. Correct.
Right. And the thing that I thought was sort of interesting is that when they made that they talked about having this joint venture developing this fuel cell, that Honda said they will be making fuel cell vehicles and General Motors didn't. Mm. I mean, because you can use fuel cells for lots of things, including replace your furnace. Yeah, I mean, you can do it that way.
By the way, that Honda Clarity is a fantastic vehicle. If you haven't driven it.
So which one?
The fuel cell. Uh-huh. The new one that just came out. It is, it's not the prettiest vehicle I've ever seen, but it is really quite enjoyable to drive. And in my view, head and shoulders above the Toyota Mirai.
So, you're all about the alternative powertrain. You're all about electrification. Can you imagine? I mean, did you think that was going to be the case, Mike?
No. I mean, I'm kind of bearish on fuel cells because I just don't understand how you move the hydrogen around. Like, I don't understand where that gets practical. Although I love, from an engineering standpoint, it's amazing.
This is a big
drive
issue.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you don't understand how it moves around?
No, they
put in these things.
I understand how it moves around. I don't understand how you practically move hydrogen. And then everyone talks about, well, we're going to do natural gas reformation.
Right at the
no
site.
One's doing carbon capture. So they talk about, okay, this is, you know, this is carbon neutral. It spits out water, and it's like, yeah, well, right now you're almost taking giant heavy hydrogen tanks in the back of a truck and moving them from mm-hmm. place to place.
Right, which is perhaps not the most efficient thing in the world, but
right.
So anyway, Clem. Thanks for the phone call, and it is not. So you mentioned the Clarity. So last week at the New York Auto Show, where the Avenir had its debut, Honda also showed their plug-in hybrid, which mm-hmm. you were also very bullish on, and their full EV.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see companies like Honda.
Right. Well, I think once you put that electrified architecture in there, you mm-hmm. can run any kind of powertrain on it. Mm-hmm. So, they're giving us options. They're playing around with stuff. It's not going to be a big volume vehicle, any one of them, I don't think, mm-hmm. for them. But it's demonstrating where this could go mm-hmm. and trying it out.
So last week, at the New York show, there was what I thought was one of the most astonishing reveals I've ever seen in my life. And it just so happens that star of stage screen and more screen, Vin Diesel, was at this reveal, and it was for the Dodge Demon. And it just so happened that the Fast and the Furious franchise continued its domination. And this really, really surprised me that they had a box office opening worldwide of $532.5 million box office. I mean, it just blew away. I mean, it even beat Star Wars. And the interesting thing is a large part of the credit goes to China.
Hmm.
So $190 million in China alone.
I think, in the U.S., it underperformed the last movie, I think.
Right. But... Okay,
but that's a lot of money.
So the car that was so astonishing was the Dodge Demon, 840 horsepower, right? I mean, and it comes with a set of skinny wheels for the front, so when you take it to your local drag strip, you can just replace those tires, and then when you run your quarter mile, then you can put your normal tires back on and drive home. So Mike, what's going on here? I mean, you're dealing with this whole driving culture.
I mean, it's one of the most incredible cars anyone's ever brought to market. It does, that 840 is when you put it on race gas. It does, I think, 808 on regular 91 octane, and it still does a 10-second quarter mile on regular pump gas. They basically made a drag strip car like a Mustang Cobra Jet or a Kobo Camaro, except they made it street legal. And that's the thing I love about it, is it's just like the idea of, no one's going to be daily driving it. Some of them might just, sit in a garage, but that you can drive it to and from the strip. The really interesting thing for me is, according to NHRA rules, Dodge made a big point of this. It's, you know, it's banned by the NHRA because it's so quick. You need a roll cage, and they didn't deliver it with a roll cage. So, in theory, you could buy one, show up to the drag strip to test it, and not be allowed to test it.
So, I mean, it was funny. I mean, so Tim Kuniskis, who runs Dodge, is basically saying that, if you want a passenger seat, we'll sell you one. You can get that option for $1. And if you want a back seat, we'll give you that option for another $1. I mean, so this thing is just, like, basically stripped down just to go fast.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, but the thing is that, I mean, I just wonder about these two data points. On the one hand, we have, you know, these guys rolling out with this car, right? And then you have this movie that is, you know, about going really fast in cars, right? That is obviously caught the imagination of, I'm going to argue, probably more of a younger demographic than, you know, people who are watching Masterpiece Theater. I mean, they're playing all that keen on.
And Mailer, perhaps?
So what's going on? I mean, I thought cars were dead. I thought we were all going to be going around in Google pods.
Yeah, I mean, they're not. You know, we had a Honda Civic Sport hatch the other day. It has 180 horsepower. I did the math. It has better power to weight than the second generation GTI, better power to weight than like two out of three older Civic SIs. And this is an economy car. And then, yeah, you go all the way up to Demon and you have 840 horsepower, which is, you know, completely inconceivable. Like nobody blinks at like 450 horsepower anymore. To me, I don't quite know where it's going. I mean, like, undeniably, we're in a golden age, and all of this technology is making it possible. And, you know, part of me doesn't see it going away, and then the other part of me says, well, we have all this autonomy and all this EV stuff coming. Like, it has to go away at some point. But all of the evidence, you know, we've been saying it for more than 10 years, like, oh, this horsepower war is going to end.
What do you think?
Well, horses are still around, so I'm thinking that these cars will, for some people, will still be, you know, it's going to be a plaything. It's a play, you know. That's all. I don't quite get the Demon, right? So it's a plaything, right? I don't have a whole lot to say about it. I don't get it, except that I think Fiat Chrysler doesn't really have a lot to offer in the electric autonomous space, except for
the Pacifica.
Yes, sorry. Yes, except for the Pacifica. Yes, but I think that what they do have is a lot of macho engines, and they might as well milk that as long as they can.
Okay, so speaking of macho engines, we have a question here that's not apropos of much of this, but so Avi from Canada wants to know about how the Maserati Ghibli is doing, and if it's not doing well, what would the reason be? And so for 2016, they sold 7,100 of these vehicles. Have you had the opportunity to drive one?
I have not driven one. I did hear, though, globally, Maserati's up something like 45 or 50% year on year. They're moving, I know it was 45,000 and they're up 70%, but they're gaining very quickly.
Right.
And this is just as the SUV is coming on. So mm-hmm. Ghibli and Quattroporte sales are up.
Right. So there you go. They're doing well. And
good news for them.
Yeah. So you need not worry about Maserati. So you're mentioning this move to autonomy. So this week, General Motors announced a big investment in expanding the capabilities of Cruise automation, that they're going to add 1,100 jobs and invest $14 million in a new facility in San Francisco. So is this just further evidence of the fact that there's momentum building and it's not going to stop?
I think so, yeah. I mean, so they spent, close to $1 billion to acquire Cruise in the first place. So this $43 million investment is a teeny little blip. But I was very impressed by the number of people. Was it 1,300?
1,100. 14 million. 1,100 jobs.
Oh, I think 40. Okay, yes. So I got my number wrong too, but it's 11. I was impressed by the number of jobs.
Yeah.
And I think it's very interesting. Ford has taken a slightly different approach on how to get people working for them on autonomous cars. And they actually bought a company from, that was a newly formed company out of Pittsburgh, and kind of are building a company around these individuals from Pittsburgh. GM, I think everyone would like to have that work happening in Detroit, but the reality is a lot of those people with that talent in autonomous drive want to be out on the West Coast. And so it's no surprise to me that GM is investing there, and I think it's it's a signal of their level of commitment, for sure. They're a leader.
So what do you think, Mike? Is this inevitable?
I don't know. I mean, we've seen surveys where people don't necessarily want it. It's inevitable on some level, like especially in cities, you know, like taxi fleets. Or you think about Manhattan. You think about areas where they can close off the driving,
College campus.
And places where pedestrian safety is at a huge premium. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that part's inevitable. You know, I still don't know how you're going to, you know, bridge it for everybody. Or, you know, you look at the fact of like other technology. The adoption rates are increasing, but it still takes 20 years for something to trickle through the automotive fleet. Mm-hmm. So it's a long way off. But you look at that, 1,100 jobs, and I think they said something like 300 cars they're going to start testing. And you didn't say it, but it was you told us about it. You know, that's not a lot of cars in the grand scheme of things, but in terms of a test fleet, that's a huge amount of data, and that allows them to move really quickly.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of surveys, I just so happen to have some data on a survey that's related to this. So J.D. Power came out with their 2017 U.S. Tech Choice Study, and this I just find this to be understandable but still flabbergasting. 40% of boomers do not see any benefits to self-driving vehicles. Are these people insane?
They're the ones that are going to benefit the most.
I know. That's the thing that occurs to me. So you basically have, like, the oldest cohort of people who are basically, nah, yeah. I'm a better driver than that robot can ever be.
I have an aunt, a cousin who is in her early 70s, I think, who has lost her vision. She cannot wait for autonomous cars to get here mm-hmm. because to her it's freedom. And yeah. I think for every boomer, I can't wait till I'm on the tail end of the boomers. Well, I can't wait till I can have someone else.
Are they going to peel your cold, dead fingers from a gear shift?
No. I mean, yeah, they'll have to drag me out of, you know, like from standing. They can't take the car away. I'm going to keep the old car. But the idea, you know, like driving on the highway, we have traffic fatalities up and everyone's saying it's due to smartphone use. We have boomers, you know, 40% of those people are probably going, no, I can use my phone, or no, I don't use my phone, and they're not really being honest about it. And even in a car, I drove one just yesterday that has lane keeping and adaptive cruise, so it helps with the steering, and it sort of allows you to get sucked into the screen, but you also think, if this thing wasn't helping me drive, I'd be trying to change some setting or change the radio and be, you know, not looking at the road. So the sooner we can get to this level of car helping,
yeah,
where you know, you can trust it a little more to say, I can operate everything. Or, you know, I mean, I don't think they're going to say, we're going to take these things out of the car. We're going to make the screen smaller and get rid of them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's an inevitability there. It's like, I think there's a safety issue. And in the scenarios when you can use it, like highway commuting, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. So have we concluded in this section of the show that we're going to have electric autonomous vehicles?
Yeah. There was a
I mean, sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not, you know, the Jetsons future.
Self-driving electric cars, absolutely. Taxis, robo-taxis.
When?
10 years, there will be 25% of miles driven, according to Boston Consulting Group. That's actually not 10 years, 13 years. By 2030, they're saying 25% of all miles could be in these robo-taxis. All miles driven, all those miles will be in a city. They won't be in the suburbs or in the rural areas. Those mm-hmm. people will still be buying their trucks, right? But that's a lot of miles.
Or maybe that's 18. I'm not.
Yeah.
But I believe they'll be here, you know, small dose by 2020, 10 years later, in big numbers.
What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Small dose by 2020, big numbers later. But the question is, you know, when people when we get to a more critical mass, are they going to have it solved where, like, you know, cyclists and pedestrians are just going to mess with the autonomous logic because they know they can? Or, you know, you always have the jerk that swerves in at the last minute. You know, you can, when you spot the autonomous car, you know, maybe you know that you can get away with things, and that creates more problems than it solves.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're not going to be able to solve that. So with that, we're going to wrap this show up. It's been great. So Mike Austin, Autoblog.
Thank you.
And a storied career before that and a storied career to come. Joanne Mueller, Forbes. So
thank you.
Thank you. And it's been really great to have you both here helping me out today. So we will be back here next week, and John will be here as well. So thank you for tuning in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.